Hi, I'm Ava Osmani.
I'm Matt Ruiz, and welcome to the You Belong in AI podcast presented by UCLA ACM AI Outreach. Today we will be interviewing Paco Guzman. Paco Guzman is a research scientist manager at Facebook AI, where he focuses on machine translation for low resource languages. He received his PhD in intelligence systems from Tecnológico de Monterrey in Mexico, and has since been working at the forefront of natural language processing and machine translation research. Paco is a big proponent for diversity in the AI community and has recently helped Facebook start their AI co-teaching program. You can find out more about him at Twitter at GuzmanHE. We're very happy to have you on board today, Francisco.
Okay, so our first question about your background is pretty much where you grew up. So what were you like in high school? What were you interested in both academically and non-academically?
Right. So, okay. I need to give a little more background about myself because you'll see it makes sense later. But I was born and raised in Mexico. I spent my childhood in a town called Tampico, in right by the Gulf, in the state of Tamaulipas. So south of the border with Texas. Later growing up, my dad changed his jobs and I moved to a different city where I did my middle and high school. But in this process growing up, you know, I was super interested in geography, and it was kind of my favorite subject. I knew the names by heart of countries, capitals, the flags, and I dream a lot about traveling to other places, meeting different people, learning the languages, you know, the cultural part, but also, you know, like the food part was really important for me, like trying new stuff. So that was always on my mind. My favorite day at school was October 24th, the day of the United Nations. And, you know, we had a celebration at my primary school where, you know, that day everybody was, you know, parading with a flag from a different country. That was like great to me. So growing up, I really wanted to be a diplomat and work at the UN. So that was my initial thoughts. That's where I went from.
That's really awesome. That's really cool to hear about your interest in the United Nations. And so moving on from, you know, when you were a child to, you know, your college life. So what led you to study physics for your undergraduate degree?
Yeah, that's a fun story. So when I was in high school, there was this opportunity to participate in this program for migrant children in Michigan. So you see, there's this migrant children that accompany their parents, their families, and they follow the crops, the seasonality of the crops. Sometimes they are picking blueberries in Michigan in the summer. Sometimes they follow the crops, the orange in Florida, and so on and so forth. So the children follow their families, and they don't have a stable, you know, school program. So they have this binational, because many people are you know, Mexican, others are American, but the instruction sometimes needs to be in Spanish and English. So they had this program, and I participated as a teaching assistant. So during this program, we received the visit of a Mexican consul from Chicago, and you know, I got to meet a real diplomat in real life and ask questions and understand that, you know, really in diplomacy, there's a lot of politics, and that, you know, it was a big turnoff for me. So I said, no, I want to do something else. So then I went to square one still when I was in high school and look at, you know, all these tests, this aptitude test that you have. And I was good for math and physics. And so I went for an undergrad program that seemed the most challenging to me at the time, which is physics engineering at Tec de Monterrey. I said, you know, I have the strengths, I will apply them. And I really liked physics and math. So I went for my strengths.
It's a really cool story to learn about, you know, how you transferred to physics from your United Nations interest. So that's really awesome, actually. So when you were a student, did your university's science community suffer from a lack of representation of diverse backgrounds, experiences, and minorities? And if applicable, in what ways was it challenging to be a Hispanic person studying physics?
Right. So I, you know, just for background, I am Mexican. I speak Spanish and I'm a mixed race person. So in Mexico, I'm pretty much part of the majority. So I went to school with people pretty much like me. So there was, in a way, very little diversity. I personally never felt as an outsider because I was part of the majority in my society. But then, you know, throughout the years, my views has changed. In France, for example, being Latinx, it was kind of a plus. People were really interested in where I came from to learn more about my cultural background, etc. So I feel like it was really a positive thing. Whereas when you come here in the US, given the amount of migrants that are already here, and especially in the tech sector, being Latinx is sort of a rarity. You know, people expect you to be in other areas. So I feel like I feel like I'm an outlier.
Yeah, that's a really great point. Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about your transition to your master's program. So what made you decide that you wanted to study abroad in France?
Right, so after renouncing to this dream of being a diplomat, right, and going into physics, I decided that, okay, I'm still gonna do traveling and I wanna know the world, but I'm gonna do it through my studies or through my work. So I did my first change program at UIUC they had a great physics department there. But while I was there, you know, you get to choose just one exchange program throughout your undergrad. But while I was there, they opened this new modality in which you could go to France and extend your studies for 1 year or so and end up with a master's program from France and the undergrad program from Mexico. And yeah, I mean, you know, I just loved the idea, and I talked to my advisor, and he said, okay, you qualified. And so I applied, and you know, I went, you know, it was really cool.
That's a really great opportunity for you. Did you like the food there?
Oh, I love the food, but more than anything, you know, it's the first time. I was very familiar with the US culture in a way because of the media influence, but France was completely strange to me. And also the language was so different, right? I mean, I had been studying French, but yeah, it was challenging.
Yeah, I totally could see that. So we talked a little bit about being a minority before, but so now that you're in a newer environment, in what ways was it difficult for you being a minority in that new environment? And what advice do you give to those in that situation right now, minorities that are just in a completely new environment?
Right. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit of my experience in France. So it was really hard at first. I remember arriving to the airport. I thought that I could speak some level of French, but just at the airport, I tried to change money and people could not understand me. And I felt like, okay, I speak this Larousse French, you know, this dictionary French that nobody can understand. And now imagine that I had to go to university and take university level courses in French. So I would come back from those courses, you know, sometimes really exhausted and with a headache because I was trying to grapple with two things at the same time, understanding the language and understanding the content. And the way of teaching is different. So eventually things got better. My French improved and I was able to catch up with the content of the course. I was very fortunate because I met people, you know, there were people who were very welcoming from the international club. And they wanted to meet people like me. They wanted to, you know, they offered a lot of helps adapting to the new culture. There also were like a dozen of international schools, international students at school, and particularly many Latin folks, many people from Latin America, but also from Spain and the Southern Europe. So, you know, we bonded very well, they became my family and my support group. And eventually I ventured out, you know, of that group and get to know many good French people. They became my very close friends up to date. But yeah, to me in this transition, it was really important to find a comfort place, like people, something that felt familiar. In a new environment, that this is my recommendation for everybody going to a new place that it feels very unfamiliar. Try to find a familiar spot first. And then, you know, people that you share a connection with, you know, it could be the language, it could be the culture, or it could be something else like a hobby. And eventually, once you adapt to the new environment, then you'll be able to explore little by little and go out of your comfort zone.
Well, I'm glad you were finally able to find a comfort place there and get to learn all the amazing things that you were. So, as you were in a new country, you know, learning a new language, is that what kind of inspired your interest in linguistics?
Totally. So, living in a new society, I started to learning more about myself. You know, I think this is a great experience. If you can have it, to, you know, anybody listening, if you get a chance to abstract yourself from your own society and put yourself somewhere in a new, very new, different place, do it. Because then you will learn a lot of things about yourself. What is actually yours, right? What is actually your identity, and what's been given to you by your context, by your surroundings, right? So that happened to me. I started learning a lot about myself, and particularly how much I love new languages. While I was still improving my French, I had Italian friends, and I started picking up Italian just by talking to them, by their music, etc. So there's also something funny that happened here during this period, which I started learning, or I come to this realization that there's no better way to connect with people than to speak them in their own language. Right. And that made me very interested in linguistics and in translation.
That's a really great point, actually. That's something that some people like maybe take for granted, but learning different languages is definitely really important. So we would love to hear more now about what inspired you to get your PhD, you know, to do even more school, but then also what inspired you to pursue machine learning and statistical analysis for your PhD?
Yeah, I said it was pure opportunity. Again, you know, an opportunity came by me, and I think it was just the right moment. So after traveling outside of Mexico for a few years, you know, I decided that I didn't want to move, that I want to be there, be close to my family. I kind of miss home. I was homesick. And I saw many of my peers, you know, applying to PhD programs outside. And I said, no, I mean, I don't want to, I want to do something else than school right now, right? So I started working in a software company. And, you know, the work was fine, but eventually it became really, you know, demotivating. There was long hours. It was, you know, it was quite hard. And in the end, you know, I was at a job that I didn't really, really love. So one of my former advisors sent me this article. I don't remember where, but about statistical machine translation by Google. And he asked me if I wanted to explore that idea, that research area with him, right? And that they were hiring for PhD students. And I loved the idea. You know, it was a perfect mixture for me, for my background, for my knowledge, you know, math and computer science, and my passion with languages. So it felt like it was the right opportunity. It really resonated with me. But also, let me tell you another reason, you know, being in Mexico and reading about Silicon Valley and all these companies and their perks and, you know, their, I was really, you know, I could see the contrast between what I had and what I was available to other people, and said, you know, I would really like to go to Silicon Valley and working for this one of these companies one day, right? And I realized that a PhD would give me a better chance to get there, right? And, you know, I was right, but I was also wrong, I must say, you know, because doing my PhD, I also learned a lot about the challenges of doing, you know, coming from a non-traditional background. So even if I did a PhD in the right area, coming from a university in Mexico, it was going to be really challenging for me to be successful in getting here. But that's a different conversation. Just a meta comment here, you know, looking back, this, just thinking about all the questions that you've been asking, one thing that's becoming really clear is that with me, right, and this is something that I know about myself, is that I'm not this type of person who said, this is my plan, you know, this is where I will be, you know. I have an idea of the things that I want to do, and I think I take the opportunities that come by. So I try to make the most out of them. So anyone listening out there, it's okay if you don't know exactly what you want to be later in your life. Listen to what you like and take all the advantages and opportunities that come your way. That's fine not to have like a super detailed plan. Just know where you roughly want to go, where you like, and explore. Have fun.
That's some really great advice, especially since, you know, a lot of our audience is probably going to be university students who are still struggling with that. That's really great to hear that. So segueing into more of what you're working on and right now. So why is language machine translation important for you?
Yeah, I see translation as a way of, you know, connecting people. I see I see this opportunity to bring people together to lower the language barriers. And it relates to what I believe, right? I believe that there is no better way than to speak to people in their own language. But this is not a reality for everybody. Not everybody had the chance to learn a new language while they were growing up, right? This is the privilege that I recognize that I have. So to me, it's about how can I extend this privilege to more people, allow them to, you know, connect with others without the barriers coming from language. So I see machine learning and AI as a perfect vehicle for that. So that became why I wanted to do machine translation.
It's really great. It's really interesting. So now we will move on to Matt asking more about your professional life.
Yeah. So like Ava said, I kind of want to transition into your professional life, some of your work experiences you've done since graduating. So let's start off with the first one. So after receiving your PhD, how did you find yourself with the opportunity to move to Qatar to research machine translation?
Right. So again, this is the recurring theme, right? Opportunities. So I was doing my PhD in Mexico, and there was this opportunity to go 1 year anywhere in the world, right? To do 1 year of a research stay. Basically, it was like a scholarship that I had. I had met people from Carnegie Mellon University at a local conference, and I built this connection with them, and they invited me to come to CMU and spend my year with them. So that's how it all started. I spent a year at Pittsburgh with them, which honestly, you know, looking back, it was a great learning experience, but I hate the cold. So the snow over there, you know, I learned that I'm not built for cold climates. I cannot deal with, you know, black rain, black ice, a freezing rain, and all of these variants of, you know, cold weather phenomena. But yeah, I learned a lot being in Pittsburgh, and I also built really good connections. Then when I went back to Mexico to keep working on my thesis, I kept working, collaborating with the CMU folks remotely. Then at the time when I was wrapping up my PhD, my CMU advisor, Stefan Vogel, invited me to Qatar. He was moving there. There's a strong connection between Carnegie Mellon. There's a campus in Qatar, but they were creating this new research institute called QCRI, Qatar Computing Research Institute. So yeah, that's how the opportunity presented to me. You know, moving to the Middle East was very attractive just because it's a completely new place, you know, and me, I wanted to discover more. So after talking to my wife, you know, and said, okay, you know, we'll give it a try for 1 year. We ended up staying for 4.5 years, but yeah, it was really eye-opening to be in such a different place, you know, so different from Western culture.
Yeah, I love to hear that. You know, it's interesting how you only expected to be there 1 year, but you know, life takes, made it 4 years. That's very interesting. Then I kind of like touched upon like a little bit of the work you did there. So what's some of the research work you did there? And can you touch upon the NIST Open Machine Translation Evaluation?
Sure. So when I was in Qatar, obviously in the Middle East, they in this country, they speak Arabic, right? Or that's the main language, although many people also speak English. But my working group was focused on Arabic language technologies. So our work there was to build better machine translation from English, Arabic, and Arabic to English. You know, so a lot of the work that we did was really to improve the technology at the time, which was statistical machine translation. So the NIST evaluation, it's one of the types of evaluation campaigns that our community does across different research labs with standardized data. And it's sort of like a competition in a way to see who has the best translation. So it helps for us, it helps to, you know, to understand what works, what doesn't work, what are the most promising technique. So as a field, we can, you know, learn from each other and keep advancing the state of things, of the technology.
Got it, makes sense. So we've talked about all these experiences and they've culminated to you joining Facebook, which you currently work at. So I'm sure you've been a part of a lot of projects over there, but what are some ones that are worthy to highlight?
Sure, so I've been at Facebook, I joined Facebook in 2016. So it's been 4.5 years. So naturally I've been involved in many projects. The ones that are closer to my heart are dedicated to increasing the inclusion of translation, particularly the research and law resource translation. This project called FLORES, which stands for Facebook Law Resource, and also doubles down, it means flowers in Spanish. So we love the acronym. So this initiative, we tackle a fundamental problem on law resource translation, which is evaluation. You cannot make progress in something that you cannot measure. And the problem is that for low resource languages, there was no, you know, high quality data sets for tracking the performance of translation systems. So we started from that point, creating very high quality benchmarking sets, so the community can actually make progress. Other projects that I'm really proud include creating resources that enable others to work on this field, creating training data so many researchers can start solving the machine translation for other languages that they care about, right? We have collaborating and created corpora along these lines, like Wikimatrix, CC Matrix, CC100. But also, you know, working on getting our models ready for many languages. So we collaborated to get XLMR to reach 100 languages. So, you know, to me, it's very important to think about the inclusion of machine learning and covering as many languages as possible.
Yeah, inclusion is so important nowadays, and we'd love to hear the progress that your team has been making. So you mentioned you've been at Facebook for 5 years, and when you joined, you're a research scientist, but now you're actually a research scientist manager. How has the transition to that position been like early on?
At Facebook, being a manager, it's different from other places. It's not really a promotion. It's a conscious career choice. For example, you could have a very successful career being just an IC, an individual contributor, without switching to a manager, management track. Management is focused on people growth and team success. And previously I was a tech lead, so I already was familiar with, with the second part of the equation, making sure that the team was successful. I just needed to work on the first part, which is growing people. But to me, this transition was tough. I transitioned into management earlier this year. And so I got I like to say it's a double whammy, because first, the transition to management is already hard by itself, but also the transition into remote work. I had to manage a remote team and myself, you know, moving into this very difficult situation, right? These times that have been stressful for everybody. I'd say, looking back, the most challenging part was to internalize that I have to share responsibility and hold people accountable. So let me explain this. Before I was, you know, used to being the driving force behind a project, but as my bandwidth is reduced because I have other responsibilities, now I have to change how I work, right? So I had to achieve the same or more, but through others. So my growth was into developing strategies and scaling my work, helping others to take more responsibility and holding them accountable. But I have to say, from all this learning experience, the seeing people grow, right, and caring about their careers and seeing how they're making progress, this has been the most rewarding part for me. And it reminds me why I chose to be a manager and become a manager.
Yeah, those are all really great reasons. And so I kind of want to bring the conversation back to some of your technical research work. You mentioned a lot about low resource languages, and I know you touched upon it a little bit, but why is the focus on low resource languages so important for representation and diversity?
As I mentioned, to me, the work on low resource languages is really about fairness and inclusion. Perhaps this was shaped by my contact with other cultures and my life, and which made me more aware of this. But I'm a firm believer that, you know, we need to build technology that is not only has a few users in mind, but that is built for everybody, right? That is not does not increase the historical gaps that exist. Particularly, machine translation is a technology that's geared towards accessibility. We really want to break language barriers. We want content of information to flow from anywhere to everywhere. The second aspect is, you know, I think I touched about this, upon this before briefly, is that we need to ensure as AI practitioners that our technology and research doesn't increase historical gaps for marginalized individuals. So we need to ensure that if we provide a minimal level of quality for everyone, and that, you know, we're not providing a group of people very good results and another group of people very bad results, because that increases the gaps in terms of progress. So therefore, in order to do that, right, we need to invest a lot of research into low resource translation, understanding how this problem is different from the high resource part. What are the techniques that work? What are the techniques that don't work? You know, there's been a lot of efforts in, for example, polishing the what we call semi-supervised and back translation approaches to work for low resource translation. So yeah, those are the reasons why I think investing in low resource translation is really, really important.
Yeah, before we move on to the next question, can you tell the audience what low resource languages are in case they don't happen to know what it is?
Sure, yeah, good call. So, you know, in machine learning, we have in supervised tasks. Supervised, that means that we have examples made by a human that can be used by a machine to learn the task. In supervised tasks, we have machine translation is one of those. That means that we have what we call parallel corpora, which are collections of translations, really, between mostly English and other languages, but it could be different. So this collection of parallel corpora are available for certain languages. If you think about French, if you think about German, these are languages that were traditionally tended to by European projects or defense projects in the US. So we call them high resource languages. Why? Because they have a lot of training data and techniques that have been developed for them. Now, on the other spectrum, you know, if you think about all the resources that are available for languages around the world, we have a very long tail of languages. And the low resource languages are those for which we really have very little data. And the type of techniques that we need to use for those are very different, because we are dealing under, you know, the low resource situations, low resource learning. That means that we need to invest either on creating more resources for any means possible, whether it's just asking people to create those and create translations for those languages, or through mining or similar methods, or invest in better modeling techniques.
Got it. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I know you mentioned that there's a big disparity between high resource languages and low resource languages, particularly with bias. And that leads me to my next question. What are your thoughts on the current state of fairness and bias in your field, or just generally AI? And what do you think are the solutions going forward?
Yeah, so I think there are different aspects of to what we call responsibility in AI, or there are many different dimensions. Bias and fairness is one of them. I think in this case, there has been a lot of progress that has been done by scientists like Timnit Gebru, that has helped the community to start realizing the societal implications of deploying AI models that make decisions at scale. And I think there's been a lot of progress, particularly for classification tasks, in which it's becoming better defined. Thinking about NLP, for example, it's better defined what does fairness mean in classification context. I still, there is a long way to what I call maturity in this area. But I think there is even a bigger gap for what we call generation tasks. And just for the audience, if they're not familiar, in classification tasks, you have to provide a label for a specific input, right? It could be multiple labels, and or it could be just one single label, right? Well, a binary classification, that means two labels, yes or no. But there are other type of tasks which are generation tasks. That means that the output is not bounded. You may have something like machine translation, in which you are to produce a whole new string, or you may have dialogue systems in which they produce responses to queries from a user. So in this context, there are other type of dimensions that we need to think about. For example, safety. How are we ensuring that generative models don't introduce unintended harms? Right, it could be psychological harms, it could be, you know, safety harms, health risks, and so on and so forth. So how do we make sure that our models don't incur into degeneration? And I think that's a bigger question that as a field we still need to make progress on. I'm particularly very interested in that direction.
Got it. That's a very good response. Then I kind of want to transition to something similar, but more of like your work at Facebook. How do you feel about the representation at Facebook and just in general, the tech sector?
So, you know, at Facebook, we have people coming from many, many different places. So we do have a level of what we call cognitive diversity, but I think it's not enough, right? There's a lot of work that needs to be done into bringing more people from diverse backgrounds, from not only a certain regions, but all over the world, right? Diversity and inclusion is something that our leadership is taking, it takes very seriously. And I am involved in several initiatives. One of them is the Georgia Tech co-teaching initiative. And they get a lot of support. We get a lot of support to start working on initiatives that are geared towards increasing the diversity in AI.
Got it. Then also as a manager with that leadership under your belt, How are you taking advantage of your management and leadership position to help solve this issue?
Well, to me, you know, being a leadership position, that's also been part of my growth as a person. You know, it's been a relatively long journey for me to get here. And now you're saying I'm in a leadership position. I think it's been, to me, it's taken me some time to understand and internalize that I'm considered a leader in this area. But during this acknowledgement, I've come to realize that I need to be more visible, that I came with the self-mandate to be out there, be visible, so young people can see themselves in AI and say, you know, I can do it. This is why I'm talking to you right now, mm-hmm. because I really understand that if as leaders, we are not out there showing that it's possible, then the younger generations may not be able to see themselves being successful in this area. So I want everybody listening that, you know, if this guy that, you know, just went from one place to another could make it here, I think anybody can, right? So it really, it's about putting your heart into it.
Yeah, I love that answer. And that's just the premise of our whole podcast, you know, just telling our audience that, you know, there are these people just like you that can achieve like these dreams that you have as well. And I really love that answer. And, you know, you're at Facebook right now, and you mentioned you've had communities in the past, specifically the one that you had in France. Are there any communities like that at Facebook, or are there any resources that Facebook offers you to feel welcome?
Yeah, so we have what we call ERGs, employee resource groups. There is in particular one called Latin Ads Facebook, where there are shared resources, there are events, and you know, there's a community that is behind it and really pushing forward. So we feel more included, right? More connected. And my favorite day of the year, to be honest, at Facebook is this Latin Community Summit. So it's a day or a couple of days when all Latinx people from Facebook get together. It's like a conference for Latinx. And we have speakers, and you know, it's just the feeling of being part, being heard, being together that makes it very, very powerful. And really, you know, it's one of my favorite days in the year. And I think there are several ERGs. There are similar events for other communities, like the Black Hat community at Facebook.
Yeah, I love to hear that. Love to hear how these tech companies are really embracing their employees and, you know, providing these communities. That's great to hear. So I kind of want to go in a similar direction. You mentioned that you're growing the co-teaching program at Facebook. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and why representation of all people, especially our newer generation, is so important?
Sure. I think let's start with the first or the second part. Why is representation important in AI? I think we all have blind spots. We come with a certain set of biases, whether we like it or not, that make us notice certain things and not others. So for example, just to give you something very concrete, there are parts of the translation system that get fixed when somebody new joins the team with a different background, right? When I joined, you know, I had a lot of experience in Arabic, and I went and fixed some Arabic bugs that we had, and the whole thing got better, right? Somebody else joins, they have a very different perspective, and they help us advance and fix bugs that, you know, we didn't know we had. And this is because they understand the cultural contexts and nuances, the cultural context and nuances of these translation errors. So something that for you may be really simple or, you know, not really an important bug, for somebody else that has a cultural context may be super offensive. And we need that. We need that cultural context, because otherwise we are producing, you know, bad quality experiences for many people around the world. So I think that we need to have more representation in for the people that we serve in product teams, but particularly in AI, because we are making decisions at large scale. When you don't have enough representation, you're just having more blind spots on your models and your products. For me, what I see here is that we are at a transition period. I see machine learning and AI becoming more prevalent in industry. And I like to think, I like to believe that machine learning engineering will be the next software engineering. So if we want to bring more diversity and we want to bring more people so we have fewer blind spots, we need to act now. So we need to have a more balanced representation in AI in the next 10 years, right? We ride this wave. So I think that the co-teaching program started like that. How can we bring more people through this ML-focused roles, helping them transition from traditional software engineering or other roles into machine learning engineering or, you know, similar roles with an ML focus. So what we're bringing to the table here is Facebook's know-how on state-of-the-art models, end-to-end applications at scale, and the responsibility aspect into the classroom, enriching our already very, very good course in deep learning.
Yeah, I love that answer. So I kind of want to transition to a new project that you're involved with over the past year. You know, since the pandemic started, the need to spread awareness for COVID around the world has only increased. So tell us a little bit about Facebook's recent partnership with Translators Without Borders and your involvement with TECO19 initiative.
Yeah, so this is really close to my heart as well. This started with a question, right? How can we help? How can we do more in this crisis for COVID, particularly in my team, what we're good at translation, right? Based on previous research on emergency situations, machine translation has been widely used for first responders to build technology to track, you know, what people are saying, you know, where are the needs, you know, for example, in an earthquake, you know, in places, say, where the first responders don't speak necessarily the local language, they use translation to track and have dashboards and monitors to see where do they need to send resources to. So translation has been a technology that has been used for emergency response in the past, but we don't know how well do we do in this new COVID world, right? So we first reach out to folks in Translators Without Borders to see how can we help. And they were really excited about collaborating in ways to supporting the community efforts. First, to translate urgent material, because that was a need, right? You know, they have connections to people on the ground in places around the world where they need now help translating things. And, you know, we have resources so we can connect, we can get the translation then by professionals and give them back to them. So that's one way we could have support. We added support. But also, you know, we wanted to build technology so translators could do a better job of translating COVID sensitive material. So we started knocking doors. We talked to colleagues from CMU, Johns Hopkins, and then Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Appen, many other companies joined this TECO19 initiative, and that's how it born. It's crazy because we didn't know that this level of collaboration we, you know, could have reached in other situations. But given the type of effort, everybody we collaborated very, very well. Fortunately, we found a way of getting together and bring this evaluation data for COVID-related domains and resources for translators around the world for 30 plus languages.
Yeah, that's actually really amazing. I never would have thought that so many of those companies and academic institutions would come together. Like you said, there's more than three or more than five. And it really just shows how like humans come together during a crisis. And I love that. So we touched upon a lot of the work you've done the past few years and many of the initiatives you're a part of right now. But what's your favorite part about doing what you do? And what do you like about the culture, about the places you work at? Can you touch upon that a little bit?
Yeah, so to me, my favorite part of the work is really the impact, seeing the impact on people's lives, hearing stories about how people use translation in their day-to-day life and how translation is really crucial in their lives. It's really motivating. You know, we have user studies and we learn about how people use translation. And, you know, again, we have our own biases informed by our way of living. You know, I may not be the best user for translation because I speak several languages and it's less useful to me. But there are people who don't speak those languages. And there are people who, you know, immigrants to the US who speak other languages, not other than English. And having translation helps them to go about their lives and be able to navigate this world that happens to be in a different language. So it really is empowering and enabling them to lead a better life. And that is super motivating to me. Also, you know, hearing from friends and their experiences with translation and how, you know, for example, I have friends tell me, you know, the Urdu translation just got really, really good. What did you guys do? You know, getting this type of feedback, it's really rewarding. And also finding, you know, how people are getting value out of the work and the research that we're doing. I met students at conferences that tell me, thank you so much for this corpora that you've created, because now we can start working on models and for our own language, and this is empowering our research. So this is really gratifying to me, you know, seeing that what I believe, you know, that giving more opportunities to people is actually having an effect in their own research. So that's been really, really rewarding. So that ties with my workplace right now, Facebook. This is being focusing on impact on the people, finding those projects that will have more impact on people, will help more. And one other thing that I really like about Facebook is that it's a very bottoms-up place. So if you start something, if you are willing to start something, then you know you will get some level of support and you will be rewarded. That's what happened with the Georgia Tech program. You know, it started as an idea and a colleague and I drove it and kept pushing for it until it became a reality, right? We didn't know where it was going to start. We didn't know what it was going to look like, but we keep pushing and we kept pushing and now it's, you know, it's a reality, right? We just concluded the second iteration of the course, and it's a testament to what can be done if you have initiative and will to push through.
Yeah, that's really motivating. That's really touching, all your responses of all your experiences. So a little extension to that question. So speaking of workplace culture and all the different environments that you've worked at, whether it be at academic institutions or, you know, professional environments, in which field do you think that representation has it best?
Yeah, I think something that is very clear to me is that it's super relative and varies by discipline and by location and how you look at things. So for example, in France, you know, we had a great gender balance for an engineering school, the whole class level. But I was in the specialization on software engineering, software architecture, actually. And there, you know, there was more men than women. But if you think about it, in the Middle East, for example, there are way more women in computer science than men. And this is, you know, for somebody in the US, it's like, what? But over there, you know, it's there are more women, many more women in computer science. So they, girls are driving CS in the Middle East. And that's fascinating, right? I had many, many interns during the summers. And, you know, it was a really good experience. And then here in the US, you know, we have a depth in terms of diversity in tech, right? And particularly in AI, we have very few women, we have very few Black and Latinx folks. And you know, the balance is not great. But again, my point to the beginning, it's really hard to compare like places across the world because each culture has its own level of its own challenges, right? How can we bring more men in the Middle East to computer science, right? How can we bring more women to AI, right? So all of these are challenges. Ideally, you know, let's think about what's the end goal, specifically for AI, that we have fewer blind spots, that we don't do that we don't incur harm, on unintended harm. So that we can actually build the applications that people need and not the ones that we think they need. And in that case, you know, having people from many places, it's really, really important.
Yeah, that's a really great answer. And yeah, I'm also speechless about the experiences that you've had and all the work that you're doing and your motivation behind all your work. It's all really inspiring. So I'm going to pass off the hosting privilege to Ava right now to talk about the future of representation in AI.
Thank you, Matt. So as you said, I'm going to be talking about future of representation in artificial intelligence. So some of these questions are a little bit related to a lot of what we've already talked about with you, but in the amount of time that you've spent in the field in the last while, do you think that representation in these fields has improved since when you started? In different fields, such as your linguistics field, physics field, any field?
I think so. And the main reason has been visibility, right? We have more and more people who are being really vocal and becoming really visible and getting out there, which is inspiring other people. So just think about, for example, the Black in AI, you know, organization and the Latinx in AI. These are groups that didn't exist before. Why? Because people found that if we don't get together, we're not going to make progress. Women in AI as well. Like there are all these affinity groups that have been created and people are getting involved and people are seeing each other and identifying common ways of make progress. And I think that is super inspiring. I cannot tell you what are the numbers and how do they things have changed because I don't have them. But just by looking at the progress that we've been making as a field, it's really inspiring to see that we are making strides before. As I said, I come from Latin America and I had a really, you know, getting here was challenging for me for many, many reasons, right? But I see that many people in Latin America right now are struggling with the same things that I struggle with. And I am getting together with other people to think about how can we lower the barriers? How can we help, you know, those that are coming behind us, coming after us in, you know, in get a better prepared so they don't have all these challenges that we faced, right? So I'm very optimistic about the future. I mean, again, I'm very optimistic in general, but I think that we are taking ownership as, you know, as a community on making this better and understanding particularly what is the relationship between us being more diverse as a field and the implications that has on the application of AI. at scale.
That's great. It's great to be optimistic, and I'm glad to hear that things have definitely gotten better, because there are many efforts that have been put in way in the past couple of years and past 10 years to try and make things more inclusive. So in terms of, you being optimistic, what, in terms of just representation, what's your ideal scenario? Like, what do you want to see in AI in terms of representation? What are the improvements that you want specifically?
Yeah, so if I had a magic wand and I could change everything, I'd say I would like to have people from every background that are application touches, right? So if your application is going to be used in Egypt, say, that you have people from Egypt in your team helping you, or at least a way of getting that feedback directly, right? That you're listening to what they have to say, listening to the way they tackle AI, they build models, they build data, right? If your application is going to touch, the Congo, that you have connections to the ground, that you are able to listen and to understand what is important, that we get out of this mentality of we know better and, we know how things should be, because in reality, we don't, right? So if I were to change, that's how I would do it. Like, if we cannot have one person, one ML people person from each part of the world, because that's not realistic either, right? That's not going to happen. I mean, just looking at the current distribution and all the work that we need to do to get there, right? It's a long way. But what I would like to see is that we're more conscious about the societal implications of our technology, and that we try to get active feedback and get people with the relevant cultural backgrounds closer to product and ML teams.
That's a great answer. And I think there's so much truth to what you said about the hierarchy that some people might see. And I think that's very important for people to recognize. So what message do you have to underrepresented groups, underrepresented in terms of like representation in Silicon Valley and representation in terms of like artificial intelligence? What message do you have to those groups that are interested in it? To kids that are, students in high school interested in it, or even students in college?
Yeah, so I want to say we need you. We need you to make things better for everybody. Not for numbers, not for statistics. We need you because we really need to make things better for everybody else. And having you here with your different background, your different ways of seeing the world, with a different language, with your different childhood story, that makes you unique, and that brings something to the table. And that makes sure that people like you in many different ways are represented and are taken into account when making decisions. So if you cannot see yourself right now, make the path, right? And then be there for others, so others like you see themselves in this field. And another thing I want to add is, it's not gonna be easy, right? I recognize that I'm an optimistic person, but it's a long term effort, and sometimes we win some, we lose some others, right? That's the state of things, but we should focus on the long game, like making sure that we're bringing more people so that our technology and our models and our science just gets better, right? There's no, it's for the good of everybody.
It's a really great message. Thank you. So moving on to the conclusion, you know, we've heard a lot about representation and we've heard a lot from you about artificial intelligence. So we just have a couple of concluding questions that aren't completely related to each other, but we think that people in the audience would really want to know them. So you've obviously traveled a lot and I'm sure you've seen some really interesting things. So tell us about one really interesting thing that you saw in your travels that you think people should know about.
Sure. Okay. I love traveling, and during one of the things that I loved being in Qatar, about being in Qatar is that I was in the middle of everything. Right. Really, the Middle East it's really in the middle of everything. I could travel to many, many places with very little effort. You know, Doha has a great airport, so. While I was there, one additional thing is that you get excellent benefits in Qatar. So, you know, we had, I think, 6 weeks of vacation in a year. So it was fantastic to, you know, to get to travel. So we spent 1 month in Southeast Asia with a baby, two-year-old baby. So that was like an adventure for us. And you know, we were freaking out because we didn't know what, you know, my wife and I were thinking, are we crazy? Are we like the worst parents in the world? You know, because we were going to a place where we had never been before, right? And for a month, you know, we were traveling from Singapore and then in train to Malaysia and then to Thailand and, you know, Cambodia and Vietnam. And, you know, it's like we did this very long trip. You know, it's one of the things that I remember is that we kind of discovered that it was just in our minds, right? Like, of course, there are differences. So for example, one difference in Vietnam is that the traffic is crazy. And then you have a baby stroller and you're trying to cross a street. And sometimes you just like say, okay, you know, I just go. And you start going through the traffic and the traffic is like a flow, a bank of fish going around an obstacle. They go around you and that's the way it is. And, you know, you just have to go, literally go with the flow, right? But yeah, I think if I have one suggestion to people is just let go of your fears. You know, of course be safe, but let go of your fears, and that will allow you to, you know, connect and really know something really different, right? I have, you know, every time I see my pictures of that trip, I kind of wish I could go back and relive those, because it was really a great experience. And that happens a lot with my trips in general, but that one was special because we were really, really scared of going and really questioning ourselves. And it turned out to be all right. And everybody's okay and nothing happened.
You're making us all very nostalgic for travel right now. I haven't been able to in such a long time and probably won't be able to, but.
Right. I mean, you can imagine, I love traveling and yeah, it's been torture for me.
I'm sure. So where, again, completely unrelated question, but this is just conclusion. So where do you see the future of artificial intelligence and machine learning? And this can be on the technical side, if you would like.
That's a loaded question. I see us as a field making more progress into lower research scenarios, exploring what we call zero shots and few shot learning. That is, you know, how can you leverage other information that you learn somehow to make progress in a task that you never seen before? Like, how can you generalize or with a very little input, right? How can you learn in those situations? Think about, you know, massively multilingual translation systems that they can translate between languages they've never seen before. How can we transfer that to other tasks and make it even better, right? Right now we can translate somehow, and there is some level of quality, but how can we push that technology to really become amazing with very little supervision? Then, you know, also exploring how can we keep learning from unstructured data, from unlabeled data? How can we start getting more information without nobody telling us what should we learn, right? So self-supervision, making more progress there. But more importantly, and I think this is where I see the future of AI, is bringing the human to the picture. Because right now we've treated this just as, you know, algorithms that live in isolation when they're not. We are using AI to empower decisions that have impact on people's lives, and we need to take, you know, the responsibility aspect much more seriously. And right now we're just at the beginning, and I think we need to mature this area much more. And I am hopeful. I think it's something that we need to take very, very seriously as a community.
That's a great point. So what are some personal projects that you've been working on, maybe outside of work or maybe related to work?
Yeah, you just stressed me out with that question. Love photography. I love photography. And this is why I also enjoy a lot of traveling, because I like to take pictures. But then, you know, I don't really like editing my pictures or organizing them. You know, so it's like I have this collection of, I don't know how many thousand pictures that I've been sitting there for a while, and I haven't organized or backed up. That's terrible. But, you know, that is sitting there. I also want to get back to my music. I mean, I play the guitar. This is something that it's really close to me, the music. And in general, arts, they've been part of my other part of the brain, right? And I think right now being having more time, but I haven't made any much more progress on my guitar. So yeah, getting back to my guitar and practicing more, and probably picking up a new instrument. I've been, you know, this is something that I've been thinking about. I started with the ukulele, but I haven't made a concerted, you know, having a goal is really important. So, and I haven't made a goal of what I want to achieve with ukulele. So yeah, these are the two things that I can think of, you know, that I've been in pause.
I see. Okay. I'm sorry for stressing you out, but that sounds really great. I'm glad you're into the arts. That's really awesome.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of You Belong in AI. This episode was made possible by UCLA ACM AI Outreach. Again, my name is Matt Ruiz, and I co-hosted today with Ava Osmani, and our guest was Paco Guzman, a research science manager at Facebook AI. This episode was edited by Jason Jewick, and the music is by Kevin McLeod and is called Cherry Monday.
Yeah, so everybody here listening to today, let me tell you something.
You belong in AI.